Today's program is brought to you by White Oak Pastures.
Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Hey, it's Sunday. Welcome to the main course, everybody. I hope we have a lot of listeners because this show has gotten really good. Thanks in large part to Jack Inslee.
And Michael Pollan.
Thank you, Michael, for condescending and being on this show. That was really, really awesome interview. Listen, it's first show of 2012, and this station has 400,000 listeners a month. And remember, Jack, you were here not from the very beginning, but pretty close. And yeah. I mean, nobody thought that that would ever be the case.
That's true.
And except for me and a few guys from Roberta's. And here we go, you know, and it's just start of a big year. And, you know, you're really running a big ship here, Jack. So are you excited?
Thanks. So excited. Couldn't be more excited. I remember the first meeting we had, I think at like Frankie's or something with everybody. And the first item was, we should really get podcasts.
Oh, you know? Brother.
Yeah, that's where we were at in the beginning.
So. And now it turns out podcasts are a majority of our listenership comes through downloads.
Exactly.
Not as many through the site, but that too will change. So do you have a good new year, Jack?
Awesome new year. Couldn't be better.
So, Jack, tell us, take us, begin the week in review, the first one of 2012.
So I need my news music when I get in the mood.
It's very nice.
Oh, thanks.
Brings gravitas to what you're about to say.
Well, like you're saying, some cool new things for the station in 2012. We have a brand new newsletter, which I really like. I think it makes us look a lot more like a publishing house, because what we're doing now is these pull quotes. So if you guys are listening on iTunes, go back to the website. It's much improved. We have these really cool pull quotes that synthesize the themes of the shows for you, so you don't have to listen to every single thing. And in 2012, we really want to be the small media option for people. So if you're sick of Rupert Murdoch and Viacom and all these corporate media outlets, that's why we're here. So.
And I love it. Our sponsors, we have six big, the big six, we call them.
Yeah.
Hearst Ranch, S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, Fairway, Cane Vineyards, Whole Foods, and White Oak Pastures. What I love about them is, you know, they don't condition what we're allowed to say.
Right.
So exactly. In a weird way, like, this is the most free speech radio station in the world, you know, when it comes to kind of green, sustainable issues, because we can do and say whatever.
Except for the random moments when Steve Jenkins emails me and says, I can't stand that guy. Don't make me sponsor him anymore.
That is Steve Jenkins from Fairway Market. A man's always speaks his mind. So, all right. Well, so, take us through the best of 2012. You know, So far, it's been a week.
Right, it's been a week, but we've had some cool shows.
I'll comment. So whatever you bring up, I will comment on.
Cool. So Linda Palacio on The Taste of the Past had a historian on who spoke about the history of restaurants in New York, which is something people don't talk about much. So I'll play a quick clip from that to give some context.
The growth of restaurants in New York is really related to the growth of New York. So restaurants really emerged to fill a need. And until people live in one place and work in another, or travel a lot, there's really not that much of a need for the restaurant. Most people in the early 19th century and before that ate at home. And the options for public dining before that really are largely taverns. But taverns really served a traveling public much more so than the public that lived in New York. And of course, New Yorkers did go to taverns, but in terms of daily eating patterns, most people ate their meals at home. But in the 19th century, New York grows, and it grows really significantly. In fact, the first half of the 19th century is the period of most growth that New York has experienced.
Yeah, and she was saying Delmonico's was really the first big restaurant that existed as a restaurant in New York.
Well, that's awesome. Well, I mean, that brings to mind that we did a great interview with Arian Batterbury, who is the wife of Michael Batterbury, who very sadly passed away before his time. But she came and talked about the history of New York restaurants. And there is actually a continuation of that traveling component, because she's like, all restaurants start with hotels. it all comes back to the hotel. And people used to sit at public tables, you know, and visit people from out of town who were kind of passing through. So she was like, hotels, hotels, hotels. So I always thought that was a super interesting, you know, aspect, that the hotel was the first restaurant for like a century. So do a search for Ariane Batterbury. And then the other things I was thinking about is, you know, all the cows that used to march down First Avenue, and then they would make a right on 14th Street, and you know, then eventually get slaughtered in the meatpacking district, you know, on the west side. So, you know, this was just a century ago. You know, it wasn't actually that far ago. And then big fan, because, you know, Heritage Foods secretly wants to write the number one publication of all time. It's like a manifesto of sorts that's going to come out right before the election. And that whole era was also the Muckrakers. And I just think about how dirty the food must have been back then, because there was just no controls. No one knew what was going on. But then the Muckrakers, these guys with their primitive cameras going around and taking photos of like meatpacking plants and this and that, were actually the guys responsible for, you know, USDA regulations and FDA. So whole fascinating history when it comes to restaurants. So yeah, great clip. I love Linda. God, she has so many friggin' great guests.
It's unreal. So it's no secret, I guess, this manifesto now. Cat's out of the bag.
The cat is out of the bag. Yeah, we're going to do it piece by piece.
Awesome. So fast forwarding a bit from the historical aspects, Mitchell Davis had on, I guess, two friends of yours, Andrew Knowlton and Adam Rappaport.
Friends is a little bit much, but I like them.
Okay. From Bon Appetit.
Acquaintances.
And they were kind of just talking about trends that they were expecting to see in 2012. And as you know, a lot of restaurants went sort of casual in 2011, like Roberta's, you know, strange seating arrangements and weird
waiters
music
with no shirts.
Right, exactly. And you know, Andrew and Adam are kind of expecting a return to service, as they're calling it, and they say that for too long the service has suffered in these casual restaurants, and that we're going to see a refocus on that service.
Well, that's interesting, because you know, I always view the two spectrums. You know, one is Roberta's on one spectrum, and the other is like Gramercy Tavern on the other. So I just warn. I mean, the Gramercy Tavern is like the number one service. Like, if I had to take someone to show them a thing on service, you know, an example, I would take them to Gramercy Tavern. But I warn that sometimes too many rules then become staid, and it becomes the rules for the rules' sake, and then you're breaking rules when you go. There's no rules at Roberta's.
True.
But most casual restaurants fail in that the waiter or waitress isn't equipped to deal with, you know, a moment or witty interactions, or, you know, dealing with the performance of a certain moment. But, you know, Roberta's is just as good service as Gramercy Tavern, I feel.
Yeah, I agree.
One has absolutely no rules, no dress code. The other one has a rule for everything. You know, within the deli world, Zingerman's is an example. I mean, they tell you how to answer the phone, how to put a knife down, how to close the refrigerator door, how to wash your hands. And, you know, both are, you know, good. Both rely on different things, and both can fail for different reasons. But, you know, I just think it's important to know that if the rules become a stereotype of themselves and just get followed blindly, that's even worse service to me. But I don't think Gramercy Tavern suffers from that. I just think, you know, certain waiters or waitresses, if, I don't know, cannot always be the best.
They called out a certain Queens restaurant and said that even with reservations, there were like 40-minute waits and people would forget about you.
Well, that's which restaurant? Oh, you're not allowed to say.
A certain Queens restaurant that's no longer open.
Oh, okay. I think I know which one you're talking about. Yeah. That is one thing. You have to give people a truthful answer of how long they're going to have to wait. Then they can make a decision and can never get annoyed. But if you lie to them for whatever reason, it makes it very hard. Well, it's an interesting casual versus rules, which is better. You know, they both succeed and fail for different
you know,
reasons.
It's not the argument they weren't making was for decasualizing these places. They're just saying the service needs to improve general, you know, so hiring better staff. And I think Roberta's, you've seen that. I mean, I know when the station started, the service wasn't so great over here, and it's really improved.
Well,
in the
I
last
think if
two
you
years.
Interacted with them in the right way, well, look at Franny's and Franny's, for instance, one of the first Brooklyn restaurants. I mean, what a great charcuterie program! There are so many rules. I'm always breaking some rule there. You know, like I ask for pepperoni on a margarita, rule break. You know, I just want my drink within 5 minutes, rule break. You know, yeah. But I mean, it also is a form of service. So, you know, I don't know. It's interesting to think. By the way, I mean, there's this whole like empowerment of the wait staffs, you know, and is there any award for waiters, like staff?
I don't know. Like, so can I jump in here?
Yeah, this is Jenny McCoy, who's going to be our guest starting in a few minutes.
I don't know if there's really any award. I mean, the James Beard Foundation or...
Don't do it, what are they doing then? That's a whole staff. Like, that should be the first award, even ahead of the owners.
I mean, there's an award for kind of outstanding restaurant, which falls under the umbrella of including hospitality and things like that. Yeah. But there's no specific, you know, they have expanded to mixologists and things like that to kind of more focus on the individual. But service director... Is there a service director
well,
award?
Well, scratch everything I've said for the first part of 2012. Until they start to honor the group of people, it's like not honoring the players.
Right.
In basketball or football. So create the award, shine the light on performance and ability to succeed in their field. And then I think people would stay in places for longer.
Absolutely.
They would be prouder of their work. I mean, in Paris, you go to a restaurant, waiters are 70 years old and have been there for 45 years.
Yeah, it's a career.
And they get paid really well towards the end, and they're part of the family at the restaurant. And, you know, they're empowered. Just like, you know, talking about players, you know, the New Orleans Saints, their defense, they can call all the plays and change them on the field. The players are 100% powerful. And, you know, until you start to see that in all fields, you know, you're always going to be kind of subjugated by some rules that some manager made. And I don't know, you know, freedom for the worker and empowerment of the worker and awards for the workers. I think I can't believe they don't have that award. I'm going to talk to Mitchell Davis about that.
I nominate Kip and Tom Barr.
Tom Barr, Brandon. I mean, you know, Brandon breaks every rule in the world, but who could be more charming than Brandon, you know, to greet you when you walk into Roberta's? So what's
awesome.
Next?
Awesome. So one more show I wanted to bring up. Kathy Irway had a pastor on from the Greenpoint Reformed Church Hunger Program. So she's feeding those in need at the church. And she had a really poignant quote, I felt like. She said, "If people have to choose between rent, medications, and food, most people will cut back on the food and then as a result go hungry because you can't really cut back on those other things, you know. So it's great that she's out there feeding people. And I know you've been working with Bread and Life with Heritage Foods. Maybe you wanted to say something about that.
Well, yeah, there's two 501c3 causes that the network is going to get behind. One is the Museum of Food and Drink, which is a Dave Arnold project, which I hope is moving along. And one which is definitely moving along is Bread and Life. And it was very funny. Charles Barkley was the host of Saturday Night Live yesterday. And one of the skits was problems that only white people have. You know, and I've heard so many people talk about, I suffer and I could use more money and blah, blah, blah. And then when you go stand in that line at Bread and Life, those people are poor. Those are poor people. And, you know, that is not a white man syndrome or whatever. Those people are just flat out poor. They suffer. Some of them are sick. And, you know, I find there's a total disconnect between the two worlds, the worlds of food and high-end restaurants and bartending, and then the situation of the poor. And, you know, that could be... So anyway, we are doing a full-fledged multi-year collaboration with Bread and Life, which is church and affiliation of St. John's University. And we are basically going to try to get our chefs in our network and the network of this radio station to go and work with the people that cook the food for these poor people, and also teaching the poor people how to extend certain ingredients and make the most of certain fruits and vegetables. So we already have a number of chefs who are on board. And then hopefully in April, we're going to have some type of 5% day or 5% week where 100 or 200 restaurants around the city give 5% of their proceeds to Bread and Life, which is, by the way, the largest emergency food bank in Brooklyn. Mm. So it's very important that the worlds meet because, you know, hunger is actually we haven't completely disconnected ourselves from that reality, even though it seems like we have to a lot of people. But
absolutely.
Well, thanks, Jack. Yeah, that was nice for you to bring up Bread and Life.
Sure. So that's it from the week. And then there's one other interesting thing. I was in my car listening to Hot 97, which is what I do. And this clip came on from a popular rapper song, and I thought you might appreciate it.
All right. Thanks.
And you do dinners at French Laundry in Napa Valley. Scallops and glasses of Dolce, that shit right up your alley.
French Laundry on Hot 97.
Man. That's awesome. The worlds are truly meeting. Well, that's awesome. Yeah. So we are going to take a small break, and then we have Jenny McCoy, who is a pastry guru. She tells you everything you want to know about pastry, and we're going to test her with some tough questions.
Today's episode of The Main Course was brought to you by White Oak Pastures. White Oak Pastures cattle are raised in a manner that has stood the test of time. It begins with southern sunshine, unpolluted country air, and fertile coastal soil. The cattle are allowed to roam the pastures and graze freely on sweet native grasses all of their lives. White Oak Pastures all-natural grass-fed beef has been available in all of the Whole Foods stores in the Mid-Atlantic states. We hope that you'll support their program through your purchase of the beef through one of the Whole Foods stores. For more information, go to whiteoakpastures.com.
Nicely done, Jack. Thank you to White Oak Pastures. They're part of our Big Six this year. Super exciting. And their beef really does taste great. So we have in studio Jenny McCoy. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So Jenny McCoy is a pastry chef, right? Is that your title?
This is true. Yep.
So just because people cannot see in radio, I've always been told that pastry chefs are like goalies and drummers, meaning they're really weird. So like a goalie in soccer, while everybody is practicing, the goalie is like off by himself, just like doing weird drills of like falling on the floor. Or like as the whole band is arriving, the drummer is like off to the side, like screwing all these parts together. And then in the kitchen, you have an entire kitchen team. And then there's like this weird pastry chef with all the beakers. And having met Jenny for the first time, or we've met before, but you know, having talked to her, I can confirm she is weird. It's the stereotype is true. So tell us about all this world. I mean, I have a bunch of questions as relates to pastry. So seasonal sweets.
Yes.
What are they? Because I know about like vegetables and tomatoes and salad bars, but tell us how it relates to pastry.
Well, you know, just like vegetables have their seasons, fruits have seasons as well. So kind of, you know, making desserts based around what's in season and not necessarily, you know, with an emphasis on locality, but also an emphasis on, you know, what's in season wherever is kind of my thing. I don't want to limit myself to never using a tropical fruit. So,
are tropical fruits key? I mean, can you do a non-tropical? I mean, everyone loves tropical fruits. I mean, are there pastry chefs that never use tropical fruits?
Absolutely. I mean, my last job was at Kraft. And so being an American restaurant, I can kind of do whatever. But prior to that, I was the pastry chef at both of the Avoce locations, which was very Italian. And so I was kind of tasked to create desserts that only used ingredients that were kind of indigenous to Italy. So The extent of my tropical fruit usage were kiwis, because strangely enough, I didn't know this until I was at Avoce, but kiwis are, I think Italy is the second largest grower of kiwis in the world. And then that was about it. So no coconuts, no pineapple.
Not a single cranberry there either, kiwi. Who knew?
Yeah, yeah.
So what's in season now in the Northeast?
In the Northeast, well, at this point, you know, kind of the growing season is sort of tapered off, but there's lots of great apples and pears and quince that are in storage and will be fantastic. There's a lot of kind of good squash. Pumpkins are kind of done for, but you know, I like to kind of broaden my array of vegetables and things that I use in dessert. So butternut squash and delicata and things like that will make their way into menus that I create.
So do you source just like the restaurant sources? You call up a purveyor and be like, deliver me a case of oranges or a case of this? Or do you try to piggyback off of the regular restaurant because you're not buying the volume that you need to make a delivery? How does that all work?
You mean not being in a restaurant anymore?
Or? No, like if you're at a restaurant, you're like, okay, I need 50 bananas. Right. And the chef's like, what? Who do we call? I mean, how is that interaction work?
So from kind of the insider's perspective on how ordering works in a restaurant, it kind of depends. But being that I've spent the bulk of my time in restaurants that do work within the seasons and have a large connection to individual growers, there's a few ways things are done. You know, when I was at Kraft, I walked through the market 3 or 4 days a week and would just say, you know, hey, Mr. Farmer, I'm going to grab these right now. Or on Wednesday, can I pick up a case of this and that sort of thing? Larger local farms that are larger, like Red Jacket, I can call in advance and say, hey, I'll have a case delivered at this point. And then for other ingredients that are not from New York State or kind of the tri-state region that I couldn't get directly through the market, I would call a purveyor. A lot of times they were smaller purveyors that were actually sourcing from the Santa Monica farmers market in California. Okay. So still very seasonal, very locally grown, purchased from the farmer, but then kind of brought over through this third party purveyor.
Got it. So is there more salt in desserts now? I mean, 50 years ago, did they all used to be sweet? And now, in order to broaden the spectrum, people are turning them into savory dishes?
I think that there is definitely an uptick in savory ingredients in desserts. I think it's something that's always kind of been happening, but there hasn't just quite been the focus on it that there is now. Certainly, salt is now not just an additive to kind of create more flavor, but it is the flavor. It is the focal point, as are savory vegetables, you know, herbs, things like that. So
it's like bacon.
Right.
I had my first bacon ice cream at Paul Kahn's place, and, you know, olive oil ice cream and all that. It just seems, I don't know. It just seems like it would be better to me personally in the middle between the courses.
Right.
And by the way, does that happen? I mean, in medieval times, I knew they used to give you kind of sweet dishes in between courses just to extend your ability to eat food. That's not really...
No, that's not... I mean,
it should happen, though.
I think so, too. And also, as a pastry chef, you know, just having more opportunities to kind of get into the mix of someone's experience and not just have it kind of be the last course would be exciting. I think people have sort of strayed away from this, but there was definitely, when I first started cooking probably 12 years ago, that intermezzo course was still part of a tasting menu. And that was kind of like a palate cleanser usually made by the pastry chef and a way to sort of move into your next course, whether it was savory or sweet.
And it would also open the door for cheese at the end, because then, you know, you wouldn't be deciding either or, because you might have gotten three desserts, you know, kind of throughout. Well, really interesting. And then I wanted to know, you are really into basically teaching or bringing pastry to a new level within the United States through the home chef, right?
Absolutely.
So, for instance, you started some organic baking mixes, or you're about to?
Yeah, so I'm doing a variety of things to kind of open the doors to interesting, delicious baking at home, kind of demystifying things for the home cook.
Tell us about that.
One of the things right now, which is in the very beginning stages, is I'm developing a brand, a product line of baking mixes, hot cocoa mixes. The company name is Cisse.
And that's C-I-S-S-E?
Yes, that's right, Cisse. And what it's doing is we are importing from a very specific cooperative in Africa, fair trade, organic cocoa, and then using that to create a line of baking mixes to kind of bring... the home cook who wants to make something from scratch but doesn't quite have the time, but giving them a really fantastic product. There's a lot of stuff out there that's very socially responsible but doesn't really taste very delicious. And then there's a lot of stuff that tastes awesome and isn't very socially responsible. So we're starting to kind of bridge that gap. But outside of that, in terms of really kind of working with the home cook, I'm writing a cookbook right now, which is all based in seasonal sweets and kind of taking some of the best of my restaurant desserts, and translating them for the home cook, making them understand that you can make these really beautiful, elegant, delicious, seemingly difficult desserts quite easily.
Hmm. So give me an example. I mean, what's a dessert that most Americans would incorporate into their weekly menus if they knew?
If they knew. So one of my two, there are two desserts that I think are my top on that list. The clafoutis, which is a very traditional French dessert.
It's by the way, Jack, for tagging purposes, it's spelled the way it sounds.
So the clafoutis is a very traditional French dessert. It's a custard that is baked. It has a fair bit of eggs in it and a little bit of flour, so it kind of has a slightly different texture than a creme brulee, and it puffs up as it bakes like a souffle. So when you eat one, you look at it as a guest or, you know, at someone as a at a dinner party and think like, oh my God, this must have been so hard. It's a souffle essentially, you know, what more daunting could there be in terms of desserts? But actually it's absolutely foolproof, you know, whisk it in a bowl, pour it in a mold, put it in the oven and done 10 minutes later kind of thing. Another one is the panna cotta. I mean, again, bring milk up to a boil, use a little gelatin to set, pour it in a glass and people think like, oh, this is so elegant. It's so light, delicious. How did you do this? And you're like, I brought milk to a boil.
But that's it.
Yeah.
And tell me about it. Is it, does it take an hour to do or?
No, both of those, you know, I think start to finish hands-on time is maybe 15 minutes and then
the oven.
Yeah, the oven is another 15 for the clafoutis. And then the panna cotta, you have to be a little ahead of the game and probably set it the night before. But really, easy stuff.
Well, this is a dessert, my favorite dessert of all time, and very only a couple of pastry chefs who've been on this show have recognized it, okay, although none of them make it. It's a Brazilian dessert called quindim.
I don't know it.
I know, but he knows it. It is
Tell me about it.
It just has thousands of eggs in it. It's like essentially a very firm custard with the little bread base. But anyway, Jack, just tag it for Christ's sake, because somebody's got to make it for me. K-I-N-D-I-N.
I now have a new project.
Got
it's very time intensive. So even the very authentic Brazilian restaurants don't make it as much anymore.
Gotcha.
But there is no real pastry culture at home in the United. There's cookie baking, right? Everybody cookie bakes. But past that, I mean, are there American pie baking, I guess? I mean, there must be.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, I think, an American culture in baking, but it's not anywhere near as broad as, you know, a professional pastry chef's repertoire or even a home savory cook. You know, you think about when it comes to the American home culture in baking, it is like you say, you know, everyone's got their holiday cookies, their holiday pies. Maybe they make a special birthday cake for someone. You know, they have their handful of you know, in their pocket recipes. But it's not something that everyone does and it generally is based around the holidays or kind of more celebratory, not just like a day-to-day thing. Whereas the home savory cook, you know, has a far more broadened array of things that they like to cook, I think. And clearly that's not just based on celebrations because you need to eat every day.
Yeah. And people think about the the calorie thing, but actually by making a better dessert less often, you'd probably be less inclined to go to the deli and buy a Snickers bar or eat all this other crappy dessert food.
Right. I mean, it's just like anything else. When you expose yourself to really good ingredients that are very flavorful and really kind of fulfilling in that sort of way, kind of really fulfilling to your taste buds and your olfactory senses, there a little goes a really long way. And you're as you eat you know, maybe more premium types of chocolates or have fresh vanilla bean, that kind of thing, your palate's going to shift and a candy bar is going to be good and nostalgic, but it's not going to be what you want.
It will be nostalgic, like the whole sambar kind of cereal mixes, you know, the milk.
Yeah, milk bars, crazy array.
So now you can troubleshoot, like if people called you, I mean, do they email you and they're like, or your friends call you and be like, oh my God, my souffle just collapsed.
Yeah.
By the way, is there a fix for that?
There can be. It's tape. Well, what you can do sometimes is you can actually cut the top of the souffle off, put a little bit more batter in and pop it back in. That's tricky. Or you can really quickly on the fly say, this is a fallen souffle.
This is it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What is so, this? But
I mean, what type of, what are the biggest things that people don't understand about?
I think one of the biggest things that home cooks don't understand is that a recipe is certainly there as a strong guide, but you don't have to follow it, you know, to the T. I think that's...
I thought in desserts you did.
You do, but you don't. And it takes some time to kind of get used to where you can kind of play around. For instance, let's say I'm baking someone's recipe that I've never made before, and I'm just kind of trying to give it a shot. I can look at it, and I have years of experience, so I can look at it and kind of look at the ratio of sugar to eggs to flour and say, oh, you know what? I think for my liking, this cake seems like it has a little too much sugar. I'm going to cut back. But even the home cook could do that. You know, if you know that you don't really love very sweet things, take out 25% of the sugar. Mm-hmm. It's not going to, you know, it's you're not going to have a cookie that is completely destroyed. Or if you do have a cookie that's completely destroyed, you've kind of learned that process. Right. And now, you know, trial next time, yeah, like try 15%, you know, and a lot of what I've learned in kitchens has been through trial and error. And I really kind of always emphasize that process with my cooks. But yes, I can definitely troubleshoot kind of on the spot. And
now, is there any dessert people that are fan pastry chefs out there that only use non-sugar, like, for instance, sorghum? Like, isn't sorghum an American item where sugar is not, right?
Correct. So sorghum is very American and actually pretty popular in the southern states. A lot of people use it instead of maple syrup on their pancakes, mm-hmm. and things like that. And additionally use it just as a liquid sweetener. I think it's a really nice thing to use instead of corn syrup in a lot of ingredients, mm-hmm. or I'm sorry, a lot of recipes. I think, you know, there are certainly a lot of pastry chefs that are moving in the direction of using all natural sweeteners, whether that's cane sugar, sorghum, or even some of the better known, like brown sugar, turbinado sugar, molasses, things that are lesser refined. I am not one of those people necessarily. Mm-hmm. I mean, I like, you know, organic and natural ingredients, but granulated sugar, white granulated sugar is, you know, it's still pretty essential.
Now, what about sweet and low? Could someone can someone overcome the bad taste of sweet and low and use that as a sugar substitute? And claim that they have like a dietetic dessert?
I'm sure someone can, and I'd like to meet that person.
No one's done it yet.
I don't even want to talk about that, you know? I mean, I'm sure someone has done that, and there's all sorts of, you know, people with diabetes and special needs, and that's fantastic. Like, if you can create something that will make someone who has a dietary need happy and feel satisfied, then more props to you. But mm-hmm. it's, you know, with my palate, I'd kind of probably... I don't know if I'd enjoy it.
So now you learned a lot of your world from a guy who I know in Chicago. He might be the best chef, or one of the best chefs for sure in Chicago, Paul Kahan.
Yep.
So he's Evac, Blackbird, Publican, and now Big Star Taco, which That's I didn't right. know about. You told me. So you said he was a real mentor for
he
you.
Was.
So how did that, in what way?
So when I first started cooking, it was right after high school. I think my first kitchen job, I was 18, and I had no idea what I was getting myself into. And I actually didn't know that I was actually in a really special restaurant.
Which one? That was Blackbird at the time.
That was actually Gordon. So when I was at Gordon, I kind of realized, like, oh, wow, there's this world of fine dining cooking. And Gordon was a great restaurant. But then I was like, but Blackbird is better. This place is, you know.
This is when he only had one restaurant.
This is when he only had one restaurant. So I weaseled my way into that kitchen.
How did you? You kept calling him on his phone?
No. I went through the back door. So I went into dinner, was totally blown away, and I called up his pastry chef the next day. That's when you could, like, get through to a pastry chef, mm-hmm. and, you know, the reservationist wasn't like, yeah, we'll take a message and no one will ever call you, leave us alone.
No one knew they were celebrities yet.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so I called up the pastry chef and I said, hey, I had dinner last night, desserts were amazing, can I come stage in your kitchen? And she said, funny that you're calling me right now, my pastry cook just gave her notice, are you looking for a job? And I said, if I like the restaurant, yes. If not, I'd just like to spend a day with you. Mm-hmm. So, and I went and I spent, you know, staging is basically volunteering your time in a kitchen for the experience and the trade of, you know, learning. And I fell in love with Blackbird. I fell in love with Paul Kahn and all of his staff and the pastry chef especially. And she offered me the job and there was no way I could turn that down.
Yeah, fantastic. So that was, it was all on, you know, hands-on training for you.
Absolutely.
So do you, a big believer in that, right? As
yes.
opposed to people who might spend hundreds of thousands of dollars, it can also be done just through going up to a kitchen being like, please, I'll work for you for free.
Certainly. I think, you know, there is a benefit to going to culinary school. It gives you a sense of the fundamentals and kind of makes you comfortable with the pace of a kitchen, the lingo used, the equipment, things like that, particularly, you know, in pastry. But it's not essential. And when I went to culinary school, it was, you know, the huge ticket price of $10,000. Now some of these programs are $100,000. And that to me is a really difficult thing to wrap my head around when entry-level pay is $10 an
what
hour.
Is the, this is a good tag. What is the minimum amount of time, in your opinion, that someone needs to stage in the pastry section, and maximum to really get to learn whether or not it's the right thing?
Because
one day is not enough, right?
No, one day is not enough. One day is enough when you've already been in kitchens and you kind of just want to like network and have a fun day and see something new and pick up a tip or two. But if you're trying to explore whether or not this is something that you want professionally, I would say, you know, spending at least a month in a kitchen full time and really kind of getting your hands dirty is going to be a way to determine whether or not it's right for you. And that might not be the lifelong decision, but in a day, you won't even know what the hell's going on around you. You will have no clue. In a week, you'll start to know some names. In 2 weeks, you'll remember where the whisks are. after a month, you might be able to complete a recipe or two.
What do pastry chefs have? If chefs have their own knife collection, do pastry chefs have their own whisks?
They do.
And what do you walk into every kitchen with?
All these miniature things. It's really funny. Pastry chefs love their mini offset spatula. Uh-huh. They love their mini whisk, their mini rubber spatula. You know, I don't know why, but pastry chefs really like little things. I guess we do some finer detail work when it comes to stuff like that. But
is there a consistent thing, yes, like a knife for a chef?
Well, for a pastry chef, I think the two most consistent things that you always have to have in your pocket is a mini offset spatula and a plastic bowl scraper. The rest, you certainly will use a chef's knife, a paring knife, a bread knife, things like that. But those are the two things that, you know, the chef's knife is a savory chef's right hand. The mini offset, the plastic bowl scraper are the pastry chef's right hand.
Very interesting. Young pastry chefs out there, I hope you're listening. So we'll take a quick break and come back for the final segment. You're listening to The Main Course, sponsored by White Oak Pastures.
I've seen the hills turn into fields and the rivers turn to streams. A lot of space from here to there and everywhere you go. It's 18-wheeler making time on his way back home. Hear that engine whine. But I'm making time.
All right, so we're back. We are with a Star Chef winner. Not sure exactly what that means, but it sounds pretty good.
I know, I like it. I'll take it.
So is Damon Bolte, right, Jack?
Yeah.
Didn't Damon Bolte win one of those? He's the
Rising Star Chef mixologist or whatever they call it.
Very nice. Uh-oh, yeah. We got a looker. Uh-oh, we got some. It's actually a very interesting theater that we overlook here at the Heritage Radio Network. It is the covered and heated outdoor section of Roberta's restaurant.
Yeah, speaking of Damon Bolte, he's dying to do an offshoot show called Table 43, where he spends a half hour just kind of talking about whoever's sitting at that table.
Oh, really? Which one is Table 43? This one right here?
Right in front of you. Yeah, there it is.
Table 43, we got a waiver. He's waving at us. So we're back with Jenny McCoy. We're talking about all things pastry. So I want to know the favorite places to eat sweets. Give us, but around the country.
Around the country, okay.
Yeah, give us a Chicago, a West Coast, and a, you know, East Coast.
Okay.
Doesn't have to be New York if that's
okay.
too much
can
pressure.
Can I throw in New Orleans too? Yes. You know, having lived there for a while, I have a
It's a big New Orleans weekend, by the way. They're beginning the college football finals. LSU is in it. They have all these playoff games. They just won yesterday. So, yes, absolutely. We want New Orleans.
Okay, cool. So, we'll start on the East Coast. And these are going to be kind of a broad array because I like to mix it up, but I am so sad. Michael Lascanus has left Le Bernardin, mm-hmm. which is great for him. He's going to go off to teach and write a book and all that stuff. But his desserts were definitely on the top of my list for places to eat sweets. And I'm sure his predecessor will do
why
quite
did
well.
Why did he leave?
He just had been at Le Bernardin, I think, for 10 years and was really kind of ready to broaden his reach. I think he, you know, one of the most amazing things about La Bernardin's pastry department is that it has a waiting list of people who want to do externships, stage there, work there. And so while he, and no one leaves there, he has employees that were there before him. So it's really hard to work with a variety of different people in a kitchen like that.
Do they pay them well, the people, or they pay well there? Or is it like the same?
It's the same, I think. Yeah. You know, I mean, I'm sure after you've been there for a while, you get paid well. And once you move into management, it's a decent salary and things like that. But entry level is entry level in restaurants. Yeah. So, but his desserts were such a beautiful marriage of the tried and true classic vehicles for desserts, flavor combinations, etc. Really focusing on the single ingredient and using them in a variety of different ways. But the way he infused kind of this more progressive molecular gastronomy methodology into his desserts were seamless.
Now, did he ever use fish in his desserts? And does anyone ever?
I don't know.
I've never seen fish in a dessert. Oh. I see bacon, but not fish.
But you know,
fish.
A fish skin could kind of be good in a dessert. Yeah. It's fatty and crispy and nice can be texture. Salty. Totally. And you know, beautiful at that. But I don't know if he's ever used fish. I'll shoot him an email and ask him.
Mostly fish restaurant, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So tell us now, speaking of fish, let's go to New Orleans.
Okay, New Orleans. So my favorite desserts in New Orleans are, I mean, this is like, everyone under the sun, even, you know, born and raised New Orleanians, but beignets from Cafe Du Monde, like that's it. It's just stop there. Yeah. And of course there's like the classics, like the bread pudding and things like that. Like I think Jazz Fest is the spot to have desserts because there's really not a lot of opportunities where you can, you know, in one day have like
8 out of 10
of the city's best desserts.
While there's listening a little to section awesome there, music. A little fair.
Yeah. So, you know, just as popular as the music is, are the food vendors and the booths. And basically it's like a taste of New Orleans.
So what do you do? Is it like wine? You take a bite and then throw out the rest?
Some might. I certainly don't.
You eat them all.
I eat them all and then really regret it because you're like out in the hot sun and kind
of
drunk.
Us West Coast.
West Coast. Again, I feel like this is, you know, they're like the beloved, you know, San Francisco folks. But Tartine makes some fantastic breads, beautiful pastries, really, you know, they're elegant and approachable, but what I like about them is they definitely are an ode to the French classics, but also kind of like the American pie sort of desserts. And I think, so their stuff is really good. And also their books are fantastic. You know, if you want a cookbook, if you're interested in baking at home and you want a cookbook that you absolutely know the recipes will work, Tartine or Tartine Bread.
Oh, good advice. Yeah. Tartine. What are your favorite cookbooks besides that one? I mean, which have been inspirational? Or let me ask this way, for an 18-year-old listening out there or 15-year-old who's like, I really want to get into it, what 3 books would you tell them to read cover to cover?
Okay, so cover to cover, The Flavor Bible by Karen Page and Andrew Dornenberg. Basically what it is an index of flavors, different ingredients, and then below like each ingredient, say it's like quince, it'll tell you the season, what the flavor type is. And then it has this whole list of maybe hundreds of different other ingredients and flavors that will pair well with. So it really is this amazing brainstorming tool, a way to sort of look in your fridge and be like, I'm going to make something, but with what?
That's great.
So that's essential.
Jack, did you get that one?
Yes, Flavor Bible.
Flavor Bible.
Jack's like, I hate you, Patrick. What else?
Let's see. Other books that I really love in terms of pastry specifically.
What about that lady from Gramercy Tavern? Every pastry chef I've ever
Claudia
met.
Claudia Fleming.
Yeah. Everybody talks about her.
Good luck finding her book. It's like $400 because it's out of print.
So what was her thing?
She was like the first celebrity pastry chef.
In America.
In America. Wow. You know, she was really the first.
She's turned into like a J.D. Salinger. No one knows where she lives. She's
right.
Like in
the I know where she lives. She's very approachable. Yeah, she's on the North Fork.
Okay.
And she owns a bed and breakfast with her husband and a couple other people that she worked with at Gramercy, which is fantastic. If you're around the North Fork, definitely go to dinner. And if you can stay there too, do it. It's great. So Claudia Fleming, you know, she was like the first kind of person to put pastries on the map and really take American desserts to a different level by infusing flavors that were uncommon at the time, but in a way that was subtle and delicious and not, you know, not for the wow factor.
Got it.
So her book, yeah, I mean, if you can get your hands on that book, it's It's kind of like a Bible to me.
But it costs $400.
It costs $400.
Is it on the internet?
It's on the internet. I mean, okay, so I'm exaggerating. If you want like a brand new copy, it's like $400. But if you can find a used copy on Amazon, it's probably, I don't know, like $120. Which, you know.
Got $170 is the cheapest I've found.
Yeah, there you go.
You're like the ultimate researcher, Jeff. You're so trained through this job. Your experience. You're like the fastest typer. You know. God.
And then book number three. Gosh, I have so,
well, that's enough.
So many
the two
books.
Is okay. Good. Are you, what about cheese? Is it usually the domain of the pastry chef to be the cheese person
sometimes,
at a restaurant?
Sometimes.
Because that seems like you guys not compete in a negative way, but
right,
like
yeah,
you're doing your thing. That doesn't necessarily mean you know what the best
right,
you know, goat cheese is
right,
in upstate New York.
So it does kind of fall under the pastry chef's realm of understanding in that it's dairy and we tend to use the most dairy in the kitchen. But at the same time, it's a little like it's a little competitive because a lot of times people are like cheese or dessert. So it's hard to not be, you know, biased. When I worked at Blackbird, I had the luxury of being, you know, the person in charge of the cheese plate. And so mm-hmm, I was given free rein to order whatever I wanted, so long as we had a goat, a cow, and a sheep, and a variety of textures. And so every week I would just order something new just to myself about cheese. But, you know, and at Avoce, we had 10 Italian cheeses on our menu, which changed frequently. And that was also kind of under my jurisdiction and totally just guided by whatever I felt like learning and tasting.
Very cool. So, you know, my final question is the toughest one, but, you know, my friend Mark Ladner told me that, you know, when he first walked into a kitchen, he likened it to kind of like a pirate ship.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like, so what is for people who are like, I don't know if pastry is for me. Like, if working in a kitchen is long hours,
yep,
and, you know, drinking after work and, you know, tough people, you
right,
know, with burn marks.
Yes,
and,
I'm,
you know,
totally scarred.
You know, and then also
so
the
ways,
timing,
yeah,
of it. You know, we got to get all these people out by 7:45. Let's go. You know, there's just, and you can't lose quality. So tell us, you know, the kind of culture of the pastry zone within this dynamic, and are you just part of the rest of the team and you go out drinking, or is your timing different? Like, give us a little
summary. Different, yeah, absolutely. So that I've always kind of equated kitchens to like this completely dysfunctional family where you're thrown together with all these brothers and sisters that you never even wanted, yet you somehow have to make sure that that ship doesn't sink. And so while the hot side or the savory side of the kitchen is always in the fray, they're always running behind, they're always in the weeds, they're, you know, screaming and yelling and being burnt and dropping things. And, you know, it, to me, I look at it and it's, I guess it's organized chaos, but to me, I just think chaos. Mm-hmm. Pastry is a little quieter, a little more mellow, because the nature of the work is far more structured, recipe driven. In my kitchen, I'm crazy addicted to lists. So really, really organized, very well planned. And the bulk of the work is done earlier in the day. So during service, when the savory side of the kitchen is in the thick of it all, we're actually already on top of our game.
You're just firing,
yep,
things.
Yeah. And there's some cooking to order and some kind of, you know, a la minute things going on, like the souffle, and fingers crossed it doesn't fall. But it, because you are working on desserts, sometimes as far as 2 days out in terms of preparing the doughs or the fillings or the whatever, it really sets a different tone for the department, which is much more calm, mm-hmm, much more. And if you don't have a really strong sense of organization, you'll totally fail in pastry. But if you have that and an attention to detail and a like a desire for some rules and some structure, then that's the part of the kitchen you want to be in.
Is it mostly women?
In America,
the great,
yes.
Restaurants?
In America,
in the
yes,
world, no.
In Europe, no. I mean, kitchens, I think in Europe it's changing, but it's mostly a male dominated world, and, you know, pastry chefs and bakers are men. Hmm. Mostly men. But in pastry in the U.S., it's like all girls. Like, my last kitchen, I had a one guy cook, and we were like, dude, really?
Well,
we're just going to tease you all day long.
Shout out to Brooks
awesome.
Headley, though.
Yeah, Brooks.
Totally.
Del Posto. Everyone likes him. He actually had all these famous dessert people over, and he asked Anne to find the most funky cheeses because he's like, I'm not going to serve these guys dessert. I got to go with cheese. Anyway, Jenny McCoy, thanks so much for
yep,
being on. Keep us in the loop with what's going on.
Yeah, and you can,
do you have a blog? Or
I do.
A website?
I have a blog. It's Jenny McCoy, JennyMccoy. And you can follow me on Twitter, Jenny_McCoy. Facebook, jenny.mccoy.nyc, I think. Just Google me, you'll find
me. Yeah, or look at the tag. She'll remember when she's talking to Jack. I'm all over the place. Well, thanks so much for being on, Jack.
Thank
Great
you
job.
For having me.
Did the live stream work, Jack?
Yes.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.